It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. The center of our service and the center of our lives, let us take more time to honor the silences in our lives. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly remembering who you are and why you are here. In an attitude of prayer, it is time to take stock of who we are, what we serve, and whether what we serve is adequate to who we are meant to be. Let us choose our beliefs and our religion as we choose our companions and mates. Let us not go where we are not honored and cherished. Let us seek spiritual paths that take us more seriously than we take ourselves, that lift us up rather than bringing us down. Let us remember that all great religious prophets have said that the way that leads toward life is narrow and few take it. We would aspire to be among those few. May we not seek an easy religion, but a hard one. Not a partial challenge, but a complete one. Let us, in this time of taking stock, treat ourselves and others as though we were all equally children of God, sons and daughters of life's longing for itself, made of stardust enfolded in dreams and nearly limitless possibilities. For we are, we are, we are. Amen. When I began planning this sermon, I didn't think it was going to have anything to do with last week's sermon on the book, The Da Vinci Code, but it does. One theme in that book, and in the huge interest that it stirred up, is the message that some religions lie, mislead people, or that even with the best of intentions, they're simply inadequate vehicles for providing enough help with our life questions. At first, I didn't think about or didn't want to think about Rosh Hashanah in that way because I've always liked Rosh Hashanah. It's one of my favorite times of year. But then when I realized that there was another religious festival that also began yesterday, one that is both very similar to and also very different from Rosh Hashanah, then it put everything in a new light. So now I think that what we're doing this morning is taking a trip through time, around the world, within and without us, a trip to God and a trip beyond God. Now that's one of the things I love most about liberal religion. We don't need to worship any creed or convention except the convention of taking ourselves, our lives, and our worlds very seriously. And in this quest, we can and do travel beyond the boundaries of any and every more particular religious orthodoxy. We are official heretics. And that's a good thing to be. The word heresy comes from the Greek verb meaning to choose. And the only reason it's been considered a bad thing is that from time to time, arrogant little groups of people have decided that they knew so much about what is sacred in life that they could declare the choices closed by defining another orthodoxy. And every time that happens, thank God, there are heretics who say, I wasn't through choosing. Now, let's begin with Rosh Hashanah. It's one of the holiest days in the Jewish year, and it marks the beginning of their new year. Jews actually have several new years, but this is the one that changes the date of the year. So it is now the year 5,764 in the Jewish tradition, although the religion itself only goes back about 35 to 3,800 years. The Jewish New Year isn't like ours on January 1st in that it's not about getting drunk, watching football, and making a bunch of promises that there's no way you're ever going to keep. It is a time for repentance and for serious introspection, for looking back at the mistakes we made during the previous year, for the people that we've harmed, and of trying to correct these before we move on. If you take the tradition seriously, this is important because they say that God keeps books in which he writes who's been good and bad and who's going to have a good or a bad year next year. The book on last year, the tradition says, will be sealed on Yom Kippur next week. So it's important. We only have 10 days to repent, to pray, to do charitable deeds, to mend our fences with others so that God will be impressed with our good intentions and might give us a better report. Now, it sounds silly to say it that way. It makes God sound like some sort of a Boy Scout troop leader. But this is one of the things about the God of the Hebrew traditions that we need to be aware of. Scholars have shown that when that God was created by the Hebrew people, he was created as a projection of and an image of a Hebrew tribal chief who set the laws, prescribed the behavioral boundaries, and promised rewards and punishments for his people. And Rosh Hashanah shows some of this history and some of this style. Because Jews are supposed to make amends to people in their community or their tribe, the ones they've wronged, and then to get right with God. The focus is on us, our tribe, and our tribe's God. This isn't news, but it's worth remembering. Now, I want to leave the Jewishness of this festival aside to focus on its insights into the human condition, our condition, because there are things in Rosh Hashanah that are as universal as any religion has to offer, and we would be remiss and a little foolish if we didn't try to use some of the wisdom that the Jews are offering all of us here. There's something important about not just stumbling from one year to the next without stopping to take stock. And that's what Rosh Hashanah is about. The ancient Hebrews are given credit for inventing the idea of a rhythm to the week, where six regular days are followed by one holy day when we're to stop working and focus on our gratitude for the gifts of life and what we owe back for this. All of Western civilization owes the Jews a huge debt of gratitude for this notion that time has a rhythm, and that we must stop from time to take stock. And Rosh Hashanah continues this sense of rhythm in a bigger way by saying that every year, at the end of every year, we should take 10 days to take stock, to look at ourselves, at how we are living, to look with real honesty, and to make changes rather than just rushing blindly from one year to the next. We owe the Jews another debt of gratitude for insisting that before we can make our peace with God, we have to make our peace with each other, with those in our community, our tribe, from whom we've grown estranged. Don't pray to God for forgiveness, they say, until you've done all you can to earn it from those in your world you have harmed, whether intentionally or not. Think of how much better off we'd all be if we did that every year, whatever your religion is. If we took 10 whole days for the task of taking ourselves more seriously, our relationships and our relation to everything we consider sacred, if we took stock and took time to mend our ways. Now, I know we can all think of at least 10 friends who'd be a lot better off if they did this. But you can bet those 10 friends are also thinking of 10 friends they know who'd be better off, and we're probably one of them. So we can go astray for only a year in this scheme before we need to seek reconciliation with those we may have wronged. Is that worth 10 days? Is there anybody here who wouldn't benefit from this kind of a discipline? And if we think of the whole world as our tribe, and that we must reconcile with other people, other nations, before moving on, think how much work our nation would have to do during the next week, and how important it would be to take that work seriously. It would transform the soul of America. Now, we're not told how to do this, just that we're supposed to do it, and God is watching and taking notes, and will write the results down in that book he's keeping. Now, I don't know about you, but I've never liked that part very much. When I was a kid, I didn't like that notion that Santa Claus did it either. That he knows who's been naughty and nice. I thought, this is none of his business. But the God of Western religions, remember, and this is so important to remember, it's such a simple fundamental point that we don't want to think of, but we need to keep thinking of it. There are many gods in the world, and they aren't all the same. And they don't all say the same things. And we need to be aware of the differences, because so much is at stake. And we need to remember that the God of all three Western religions began as a tribal chief. Even the covenants written in the Old Testament between God and his people, scholars have shown, are modeled after Hittite treaties of rulers and people from 3,000 years ago. The Hebrew religion began, as you may or may not know, as a departure from the Canaanite religion around it, which was a powerful nature religion with a goddess, a divine mother, a mother nature at its center. In their early years, up till about 2,600 years ago, the Hebrews were not monotheists. They were polytheists. They worshiped the gods and the goddesses of their surrounding culture as well as Yahweh. Remember, even in the Ten Commandments, Yahweh only wants to be number one among their other gods. King Solomon, regarded as the wisest of the wise Hebrew rulers, worshiped both Yahweh and the goddess Asherah. And he had a statue of this great goddess in his temple to balance the masculine and the feminine divine energies. So the Hebrew religion used to be very different. But about 2,600 years ago, a very conservative and a very exclusive change came. After they had been captured by the Babylonians, and some Jewish thinkers decided that this capture was God's punishment of them, and he was sending them a message, and that this prophet happened to know what the message was. Prophets are always saying that. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. And in this new, more conservative and exclusive religion, all the goddesses were banished. Some of the signs of this are still there, and some of them are very funny once you know how to read them. For instance, the creation story of goddesses, of nature goddesses, is always that they've created these things out of themselves, because that's how females do it in real life. And it's funny to read ancient Hebrews taking a female creation story and adapting it to a male god who they say now created everything from himself. Now that's funny. You don't have to laugh, but it's funny. But the religion became a religion in which both feminine power and women were second-rate religions, as hundreds of millions of women in all three Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, can testify to and have been able to testify to for many centuries. That choral piece that the choir did this morning, where they changed the sex of God. I don't know how shocking that sounds to you. I'll admit, the first time I heard it, it woke me up, and I thought, wow, that's different. The choir did that piece at a Christmas festival for the North Central Caregivers that our church helps out with, and they performed it at a Missouri Synod Lutheran church. And I had some really angry voicemails from the minister of that church, who told me that the people in her church, in his church, were all deeply offended. And I called him back and said, I had not known. I knew it was a Lutheran church. I had not known it was Missouri Synod. I assumed it was ELCA. And if I'd known it was Missouri Synod, that wouldn't have been a wise song for our choir to take. Fine. But I'm sorry. If your concept of God is so narrow that it can't even include the feminine energies of life, it's just too small. That's not adequate to any concept of God. I'm sorry. So Yahweh remains a kind of tribal chief, a male tribal chief, who wants his people to get along and to worship him, but has no room for people finding alternate roots or alternate gods. We all know this. It's a hallmark of Western religions. There's no news here. In fact, we know it so well, you may wonder why on earth I bothered to bring it up. I brought it up as a segue to talk about the other religious festival that started yesterday. Yesterday was the Hindu festival of Navaratri, which I'm sure I pronounced wrong, also known as the Durga festival. I'm betting, and I would bet some money on this, that almost nobody here has ever heard of it. Anyone ever hear of it? I win. One hand. Like Rosh Hashanah, this is a time for Hindus to take stock, though the scope is much broader, and there's a different feel to this in the Hindu tradition. I think Hinduism has the broadest horizons and the most imagination of any religion in the world, and all that shows up in this. The most abiding human failing in Hinduism isn't sin, as it is in Western religions, it's ignorance. We don't realize our real identity, and our lives are lived in the service of lesser identities that aren't worthy of us. Our real identity is infinite and eternal, not just limited to this life here and now, and we keep forgetting that, the Hindus say. Our modern physicists tell us that the theory du jour in physics is still the Big Bang theory, that everything in the universe started with the Big Bang, and that everything that exists everywhere in the universe, therefore, including us, is made out of stardust. Now, I think that's a lovely story, and a Hindu teacher could have written it. But Hindu understandings of God and gods is very different from Western understandings. The overall reality, they say, is called Brahman, the sum of all creative, sustaining, destructive, magical, miraculous powers in the universe. But Brahman is not a god. Brahman is an abstract concept which can't be reduced to a human form. Still, Hindus know that people don't relate well to abstract concepts, and so they have created, from their wonderful, wild, and vivid imaginations, many gods and goddesses to give more useful images for people to focus on. Some of these are very wild. gods with the head of an elephant and four arms or eight arms, depending on the picture you see. I have that god in my office. His name is Ganesha, and I like him a lot. Hindus don't take him literally. How do you take literally somebody with four arms and the head of a god, for goodness sakes? Head of an elephant, I mean. See, I've already confused him. But Buddhists rub his tummy before starting something. Ganesha is the god that you pray to or make or give fruit and sweet water and things to before you begin a new undertaking. It's something you do for luck. It's kind of like knocking on wood or rubbing a lucky stone. All their gods, from the wild elephant-headed Ganesha to their more major gods like Krishna, Shiva, and Vishnu, and all the goddesses, are not beings. The Hindus are very clear about this. They don't exist except in a highly imaginative sense. It demands a lot of you. And both male and female powers are recognized as essential. As one Hindu teacher explains it, the Divine Mother is the cosmic energy and the omnipotent power of God. She's called many names, and one of them is Durga. So the supreme power of God, they say, is manifested as knowledge, as activity, and as strength, personal strength, spiritual strength, strength of character. Those are the traits we should have. That's why they're what the gods are about. It's what all religions are like. And each of these traits is represented by a goddess on whom we can focus during this time, the festival of Durga, to draw ourselves closer to that kind of energy. It's remarkable to me how much this is like the teachings of the Gnostics in the first century of the Christian era. They also taught that the highest God was impersonal and could not be represented in human form, a concept much like Brahman, and that Yahweh was actually just a second-order deity created by the main God to do the work of creating things like the world. And so the Gnostics taught that the Jews and the early Christians had completely misunderstood the nature of God by worshiping Yahweh, the second-order creation. Hindus could have taught all this. Like all religions, Hinduism grows out of the kinds of human questions and longings and yearnings that have always been with us. That's why we can find so much in it, as in Judaism and any other religion, that's useful and profound and moving and imaginative. What we're talking about is the same condition of being disconnected and out of sync that Rosh Hashanah is talking about. But here, our identity is not as members of a tribe or worshipers of a local god. In Hinduism, our identity is as parts of all the infinite and eternal elements of the universe. We're made of stardust, and our true home can't be contained by anything less than infinity and eternity. It's a magnificent image. What keeps us blinded to our real nature? The Hindus say it's at least three things that we are to try and combat during this time of year, aided by the divine Mother Durga in several of her forms. First, we are blinded by ignorance and the unhappiness that goes with it. The goddess Saraswati, one of Mother Durga's manifestations, aids by drawing us toward knowledge and happiness. We should seek knowledge and truth and happiness rather than their opposites. And the infinite and eternal energies of the universe want to help us do that. So they've taken the imaginative form of this goddess, rather than a judge that keeps score in a book. See how different this feels? It's a very different way to look at life and gods and the sacred in ourselves. Second, we're misled by pursuing the wrong kind of wealth. Now, this is a message of all religions. In the Christian scriptures, Jesus asks, "What does a person gain if they gain the whole world and lose their soul?" And the ancient Hindus asked the same question. Here, they use the powerful and very sexy goddess, Lakshmi, as the part of us that wants to help awaken us to and excite us by the spiritual and physical pleasures of life rather than the material ones. Lakshmi wants to make us fall in love and in lust with the world that's here free for the taking. Sex, for Hindus, is a good natural thing rather than a sin, as so many Western religions often regard it. And that happens if you're going to leave the goddess and the feminine powers out of a religion. Again, Lakshmi is not our judge. She is the part of us that is there to help us if we'll wake up and let her in. And third, we're held captive by inertia, indolence, sleep, laziness. We may be in a rut, but it's our rut. And we know it, and we're staying there. It's more familiar than the other possibilities for life that might be happier, but aren't familiar. This is a huge obstacle, this inertia, this rut. It's just huge. And the Hindus say it takes tremendous force to help us break free. And if you know anything about Hindu stories, you know, as we say in the West, this is a job for Superman. In the Hindu culture, they'd say this is a job for Kali, this terrifying goddess. Kali is pictured with blood dripping from her teeth. That's how powerful she is. But what Kali is about destroying isn't mortals. It's spiritual demons. Kali is the power, they say, that's within us and available to us to destroy the spiritual demons that drag us down. That's fascinating stuff. So we can appeal to Kali to combine with the other aspects of Mother Durga, the Divine Mother. And the Durga Festival is a reminder, just as Rosh Hashanah is, that we need to stop and to take stock and look inside ourselves and at our lives and retune them. Just as an orchestra gets in tune by listening to that A that's played by the oboes before the orchestra begins, so we need to get in tune by listening to those still small and powerful voices within us that the world's great religions picture as gods and goddesses. In some way, these two festivals are what religion's about. They're the voices saying, wake up! You're asleep. Life's too important to sleep through. Don't live your life around unworthy centers. Wake up! All the energies of the universe are here to help you if you just let them. But look at the difference between how these two great religions do it. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam have all struggled throughout their histories to outgrow the shadow of the old tribal deity who lays down commandments, who rewards and punishes, and who seems unable to offer us the other half, the feminine half of life's energies and magic and mystery. And there's always that theological limit in Western religions, that hidden message that whatever we do has to be in the worship of only this one God, not all the others. And how different Hinduism is here. You can appeal to these powers through either the three-part Divine Mother or the three-part male deities of Krishna, Vishnu, and Shiva. If you protest that you don't think any of these gods really exist as beings, the Hindus will congratulate you. And they'll say, I'm so happy you've grown to this level. Now religion can be more meaningful and more powerful and take roots in your soul, in your mind, in your life, where it belongs. Now you see why I said this was like a trip through time, around the world, within us and without us, a trip to God and a trip beyond God. The great German poet Goethe once said that the person who doesn't know two languages doesn't really even know one, because he thinks that his one way of speaking must be the truth. Same is true in religion. For centuries, people in Western civilization have been taught that there's only one basic center, this God that was once a tribal deity and now has so many other layers of meaning, but is male. We have killed collectively hundreds of thousands of other human beings who didn't see it that way. Now that, you've got to acknowledge, can't possibly be done in the service of a true God of love. So I think we're left with the same kind of insight and the same kind of troubling questions suggested by the book The Da Vinci Code. The suspicion that some major religions, no matter how well-intended, have misled us or have failed to give us adequate help, that they sometimes make us more out of balance rather than more whole. And so it's the season of Rosh Hashanah, the season of Mother Durga, when we're asked to take stock, to repent of ways of living that do not honor us or our highest calling. That's a sacred time. No matter how you put it, in what religious terms, that's a sacred time. If I were a Jew, I might tell you to think of this in terms of Yahweh and that book that he's keeping on you. If I were a Hindu, I might suggest that you honor the divine energies you seek through the imaginative goddesses of Saraswati, Lakshmi, and Kali. But I'm a 21st century religious liberal. So instead, I'll simply remind you that this is indeed the beginning of a new year, and it's time to take stock. It's the beginning of a new school year, a new church year, a year with a new ministerial intern, a new director of religious education, a new pledge drive. All these things are starting, and it's time to take stock. All around us are materials and people and stories and myths with clues about how we might do it. Some of you will call this power God. Some very few of you might actually call it Durga, or the Divine Mother. More of you would call it that. Personally and professionally, I don't care what you call it. I only care that you can call it forth. We're not here to take orders from religions. We're here to audition them, to see if they would lift us up or bring us down. And so, call it forth. For that power, if we will seek it, knows our most sacred name and our most holy calling. It is always here, always available, just waiting to be called forth. Now it's our move.